Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
This episode of Global Journalist was originally recorded on November 15th, 2012.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Ken Paulson is President and Chief Executive Officer of the First Amendment Center, and he's among the 2012 Missouri Honor Medal winners. The school gives the annual awards for distinguished service in journalism. Paulson was the editor or managing editor at newspapers in five states. He launched online newspapers, and he was part of the team who founded USA Today in 1982. After receiving the Honor Medal, Paulson spoke with Global Journalist reporter Nina Panic in the studio about his work to promote First Amendment issues. Another highly regarded advocate for the nation's constitutionally protected freedoms is Charles Davis. Charles is a Missouri School of Journalism professor who is here in the studio to add context to Paulson's comments. Welcome to Global Journalist, Charles.
Pleasure to be here, David.
We'll start the program by hearing Paulson describe what first got him fired up about those constitutionally protected freedoms.
You know, I was privileged to attend what I regard as the best journalism school in the world. I came to the University of Missouri in the mid-70s. And I was a child of the 60s, which obviously dates me. And I saw how the First Amendment transformed society, using the powers of the First Amendment and the core freedoms. The civil rights movement was fueled. The women's right movement was fueled. A lot of dramatic and positive social change had occurred. So by the time I got to journalism school, I already got that the First Amendment was this powerful and important thing. And then I had a course in media law, a professor at the time named Dale Spencer, who really brought media law alive for me and made me understand that freedom of the press and protecting freedom of the press was critical to preserving a democracy. It turned me on. And I just decided I was going to go to law school from that point on. And I spent the rest of my career, frankly, alternating between being someone working in First Amendment law, an advocate, an educator about in that area, and then being a newspaper editor, which is a lot of fun. And I've been blessed to be able to do a lot of both.
What made you think that the First Amendment was so important to focus on?
You know, we do take the First Amendment for granted in this country. 45 words, ratified in 1791, unchanged, but not unchallenged in that period. And it's unlike any set of freedoms anywhere else in the world. All over the globe, people believe they embrace these values. They believe you can say what you want and dress as you want and believe as you want. But that doesn't really hold up most of the time. Recently we've had this controversial Innocence of Muslims video in California on YouTube that caused rioting around the world. And the Arab League went to and announced that they believe there needs to be a worldwide ban on mocking religion. A ban on blasphemy, if you will, but essentially a ban on saying anything negative about anyone's religion. Well, that's extraordinary. That's troubling. That would be a worldwide ban on freedom of speech. Other countries, and this is a broad generalization, tend to say, yes, we believe in freedom of speech, but in this country we say we believe in freedom of speech. And there are very few exceptions to these core freedoms. And the reason the United States has been the most creative, dynamic, powerful and influential country in the history of the world is largely because of the five freedoms of the First Amendment. And I find that very exciting.
How do you think there's a problem with Americans and the First Amendment? Do you think that sometimes they don't really quite appreciate it?
Teachers are under a lot of pressure. They have a curriculum they have to teach, and for some reason, nowhere along the line has anyone said, you know what, the First Amendment, that's a cornerstone of our democracy. We need to teach that early, and we need to teach it well. You know, I talk to people all the time, and I say, so when did you learn about the First Amendment? And they'll kind of scratch their head and say, well, maybe in the fourth grade, but I don't really remember. We do a survey every year, ask Americans, can you name any of the five freedoms of the First Amendment? One in 25 can name the five freedoms. A majority can name just freedom of speech. We are constitutionally illiterate, and in particular about the First Amendment. And the reason that's important is that our other surveys say that a full fifth of Americans believe the First Amendment gives us too much freedom. And that's astonishing. And that's a phenomenal number of Americans, tens of millions, who think the First Amendment shouldn't apply with the same intensity it does. And in the days following the tragic events of 9/11 in 2001, we did some surveys along the same lines. That number jumped from 20% to 49%. Essentially, one American in two said, clearly we've been too free. And that's a very dangerous place to be. So, you know, much of my work today is about reminding Americans that these five freedoms are critical and that we need to protect them at all costs. And if we're afraid, if we've been rattled, we need to fight back and say, no, some things we will not compromise on. We will not compromise on the five freedoms, and that's what America's all about.
How does our freedom of speech compare to, like, on a global scale with other countries?
We're off the charts in terms of freedom of speech. No nation is more free than the United States of America, and we would hope to keep it that way.
And then when you started the One for All campaign, what was the significance of that for you?
We've discovered over time that with very few schools committing to teach about the First Amendment in any depth, that we need kind of a workaround. We need to raise awareness about the First Amendment in unconventional ways. And so I gathered a group of people in 2007, educators, artists, attorneys, advocates, and simply said, we know that most Americans don't know anything about the First Amendment. How do we turn that around? And we concluded that marketing would be a big part of that. Think about the Got Milk campaign, Milk Mustaches on Celebrities. That was introduced at a time when milk was not very popular, had lost market share, and they're trying to make this kind of hip and contemporary. Well, you know, you talk about a dated product. The First Amendment was invented, if you will, in 1791. It will fall out of fashion if we're not paying attention to it. So what we did was put together an organization called One for All. It stands for One Amendment for All Americans, the First Amendment for All Americans. And the Knight Foundation, the McCormick Foundation, the American Society of News Editors, the Newseum, First Amendment Center, and USA Today were all initial partners in this project. And together we reached out to news organizations across the country. We reached out to celebrities, and for the last 3 years, we've run national campaigns. You'll see ads in newspapers and magazines showing either young people enjoying the freedoms of the First Amendment, or you'll see celebrities conveying their passion for the First Amendment. So like Blake Shelton, we had an ad that said, free to tweet. He was a notorious user of Twitter. Brad Paisley, big ads that said, free to play. Kesha, free to sing. And that's helped raise the visibility of the campaign. Last December, on the 220th anniversary of the Bill of Rights, we worked with the Knight Foundation on something called Free to Tweet. And that campaign involved asking young people all over the country to tweet about the First Amendment. 17,000 did, and the top 22 most creative tweets won $5,000 scholarships. And I knew we were home free when President Obama tweeted from the White House. That felt very good.
Do you think there's been a difference in the freedom of speech in America in the past decade?
We're in an interesting period of transition. With digital media and social media, the First Amendment is actually as vibrant as it has ever been. The First Amendment gives us freedom of speech, and in many ways it's been revitalized. You think about the core concept of free speech in America. The idea is, I respect your point of view. Well, I don't even have to respect your point of view. I'm willing to acknowledge you have a right to express yourself. and I have a right to express myself. And then hopefully, if we're all expressing ourselves collectively, we get smarter, we have more perspectives, we do the right thing. And so it's worked that way since essentially colonial times, the founding of this nation. Today, everybody can talk to everybody instantly, globally. So whereas somebody once stood on a street corner in Cincinnati, Ohio, and said, I feel very strongly about taxes, same guy can go tweet and potentially reach millions of people instantaneously with his tweet. I mean, look at what goes viral, things that capture people's imagination. It didn't, in previous generations or even 10 years ago, an incredibly clever person standing on a street corner would have no audience, but the same thing condensed to a tweet as it can reach people. So in many ways, free speech has never been more vibrant. There are challenges that are accompanied by social media, a lot of irresponsible content, a lot of inaccurate reporting. But by and large, free speech has never been more vibrant.
You mentioned Twitter. There's been cases where a reporter has been temporarily suspended from Twitter, and there's been cases where coaches restrict players from what they can and can't tweet. Is that a problem with freedom of speech?
In every case involving freedom of speech in America, you have to ask one basic question. Is the government involved? Because the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law, and courts have concluded over time that that also applies to every governmental body. But freedom of speech guaranteed by the Constitution is really a defensive measure that says the government can't interfere with us, but private companies can. You talk to people who are unhappy in the workplace, there's sometimes a sentiment, why can't I speak out about what's wrong? Well, because you don't have a free speech right in your workplace. They pay you, and they can decide whether you continue to work there or not based on how you conduct yourself, how you do your job. If you doubt that, and you're employed in a workplace, I suggest you band together your coworkers and march on the boss's office and see what happens. So in the private sector, there is no real free speech. But if there's government involvement, there is. So when you talk about Twitter banning a reporter for what they regarded as a violation of the rules, it had every right to do that. They're a private enterprise. They can do that. Now, I've written about that, and I think Twitter ought to take a very long look at what it did in this case. A reporter from The Independent was critical of NBC for its Olympics coverage, and he tweeted the email address of a NBC executive. And then Twitter, upset with that, or perhaps responding to a complaint, decided they were going to tell this reporter he couldn't use Twitter anymore. In the first place, that email was somewhat available on the web. It wasn't a private, truly private email. Secondly, this was a matter of significant public importance and in the public interest. But here's what is of the greatest concern to me is that if we have tens of thousands of journalists using the Twitter, it's a very effective tool, undiluted, instantaneous communication with your readers. What happens when a private company says, okay, you're done? I mean, they could literally knock tens of thousands of journalists out of this communications network on a whim. And so they need policies, internal policies. And they need to make a pledge, frankly, to journalists and the public alike that the default position of Twitter is always going to be for free speech.
You've also talked about Facebook and Facebook liking. Do you think that's something also that should be maybe considered as protected under the First Amendment?
There's an interesting case in the state of Virginia in which an employee of a sheriff's department during the height of election season decided they'd prefer to support the sheriff's rival. And so how do you convey support for the rival of your boss? Well, in this case, a couple of employees went on Facebook and liked the page of the sheriff's rival. This did not set well with their boss, and the minute their boss was reelected, the sheriff fired these individuals. It's an employment relations case. There's a lot of factors involved, but one of the factors was, well, was that protected free speech? Could employees go ahead and like a Facebook page as an exercise of their First Amendment rights, in which case they probably couldn't have been punished for that. And a federal judge has now concluded that, no, liking a Facebook page is not free speech. And that's almost certainly wrong. But that happens sometimes. And it often happens with new and emerging technology because judges... There's no course on new and emerging technology your third year in law school. There's no continuing legal education typically on dealing with breaking media. And so in this case, he said, well, you know, it's just basically a flick of the mouse. It's not really speech. It's not expressive enough. That's clearly wrong. Because if the individual had said, I like Bob Smith, verbally, everyone would understand that that was speech. And that's what clicking that like button is. But it does show the gap sometimes between a changing society, changing media, and the judges who have to enforce the laws. And I would say almost certainly that decision will come out a different way in the future.
Should the same kind of approach be applied to retweets?
To?
Retweets on Facebook, on Twitter, when you retweet something, it's kind of like voicing an opinion the same way? Or
well, certainly retweeting is free speech. You are communicating to third parties with information. So sending somebody a URL would be free speech. It's valuable to remember that freedom of speech and freedom of the press, that's not just you speaking. It's you disseminating information. It's also you essentially saying, I believe in this information, I'm going to share it with you. And having the right to access information is also part of freedom of speech, which is why libraries are not allowed to censor content for ideological reasons.
So there's been cases where, like, film, internet, and I don't know what it was, but either way, they take 10 to 20 to 30 years to get protected under the First Amendment. Do you think that something like Facebook and Twitter will eventually be protected?
Well, to be clear, Twitter and Facebook are absolutely protected under the First Amendment. There's no question that they are forms of communication the government cannot interfere with. The only question has been individual government action as applied to liking somebody on Facebook. It's really a very narrow and obscure part of the law, but it's illustrative that there's a disconnect sometimes between the technology and those who have to enforce the laws. But, you know, everything is protected by the First Amendment, essentially. Every form of art, every form of music, every form of speech, all social media, all digital media, with rare exceptions for obscenity and child pornography and efforts to rally people to commit violent acts. Essentially, across the board, everything we read and ingest into our brains is protected by the First Amendment.
You mentioned the YouTube video, Innocence of Muslims, and how countries are blocking Gmail, blocking Google. Do you think something like that could ever happen in America?
I've been amazed at the reaction globally to the Innocence of Muslims, and it's probably... I just probably don't appreciate other cultures the way I might. What I love about the United States of America and Americans generally is that they get that there are many voices out there, and rather than attempt to burn down a building, they're more likely to call somebody a loon, mock them, on the check out the YouTube video, and you'll see endless sarcastic remarks. Many of them not very enlightened, but what a healthy way to react to things with which we disagree. The answer for offensive speech is more speech, and America gets that, and Americans get that, and so they're very likely to boo, more likely to boo than to throw rocks, which I think is probably a healthy way to live our lives if we're going to disagree strongly with something.
You've been listening to a pre-recorded interview with Ken Paulson, the head of the First Amendment Center in Nashville, Tennessee. Before we hear from Professor Charles Davis, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org. Or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at Global Jorn. That's Global JOURN. First, let's compare those final lofty comments about the nature of Americans with Paulson's first statement about the general ignorance of the First Amendment protections, Charles.
Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum. Americans seem to have very little understanding of the First Amendment, but what they think about it, they like. So it's this fascinating contrast. When you ask people very general questions about freedom of speech, you get pretty decent support. But when you start drilling down into specifics, as Ken pointed out, the numbers erode very quickly. And some of those measures are downright frightening.
Now, what are some of the dynamics that have changed in recent years? I guess maybe we can start with 9/11.
Yeah. I mean, the two biggies, 9/11 and the tragic events of that day, and it sort of sent shockwaves to the system of free expression in many ways. And then, of course, like everything in American life these days, the internet and the migration to digital technologies and these instantaneous forms of communication that Ken was speaking about earlier have had tremendous impacts and continue to have tremendous impacts on free speech.
Let's break those into two different topics. We'll start with the restrictions that happened after the terrorist attack and efforts to keep it from happening again.
Yeah, I mean, I think now that we're 10, 11 years out from the event, I remember distinctly, we all remember where we were that morning. I was on my way to drop my daughter off at her first day at preschool and then head off to my class, which ironically enough was Controls of Information, my Freedom of Information, Government Access to Government Documents class. And I can remember driving to campus thinking, wow, nothing is ever going to be the same again when it comes to this stuff. And yeah. My optimistic view a decade later is that while it certainly rattled the foundations of free expression and access to government information, we didn't do much, really. I mean, the walk away a decade later is while there were many threats and there were many passionate discussions about whether or not we should curtail freedom of speech in the wake of September 11th, cooler heads prevailed again and again and again, with the rather large exception of the Patriot Act and the rise of the surveillance state, which we could devote probably an entire show or two to. There are certainly issues, don't get me wrong, but we didn't, you know, amend the First Amendment based on the events of September 11th in the way that I actually kind of anticipated that day we might be looking at wholesale change. And the changes were much more incremental.
Has the Supreme Court weighed in very heavily on this issue in the interim?
Not in the speech context. This is a court, of course, pretty newly constituted, and they've weighed in on several other important First Amendment cases, not the least of which Citizens United. But they've been relatively muted when it comes to speech in the anti-terrorism context.
And we'll move on to the internet and how that has affected free speech. You know, we both went to journalism school here back in the day before the internet was even around.
Yeah.
So we've seen this expansion that has raised a lot of interesting First Amendment issues.
It has. And there are a multitude of issues that are of great interest to those of us who study media law. Probably two of the biggest, I guess we could focus on them, anonymity, the nature of the sort of immutable fact that a whole lot of what goes on the internet is unknown users engaging in all kinds of nefarious behavior. And the question arises when someone is libeled online, for example, if someone is posting in a comments page of a newspaper and 80 comments down says something truly defamatory about somebody else, but does so through the cloak of a pseudonym.
Right.
And you have no registration information because they dummied all that up and gave fake addresses and fake phone numbers. How in the world can you keep tabs on those people? And should you? And if you can keep tabs on those people, at what point do you step in and identify them? Because ultimately, the inescapable fact of the internet is nobody's really anonymous, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can dummy up the registration all you want, but if they want to come find your internet domain address and hunt you down, they can. So it raises a very real question of these competing values of anonymity and the protection of reputation.
Yeah, Ken was in comments that we didn't have time to air. He was talking about how the comment boards have become the cesspools of the internet. He said that when he was editor of USA Today, he stopped using anonymous sources completely because he was saying that people don't trust your your credibility with anonymous sources, and they only used anonymous source when they considered it just crucial and when it really mattered. Do you think that there may be a boomerang effect of sorts, that people are going to become coming more to back to media that is considered more credible and doesn't use anonymous sources? And
it's a great question. Ken, who's a dear friend, really showed some unbelievable leadership at USA Today when he came in as editor and literally stopped using anonymous sources. This was a newspaper, just like all the other national newspapers, that had grown really heavily addicted to anonymous sourcing. And so it was a real moment of cold turkey for them, in which he literally stopped overnight. He argues that it really didn't change the reportage in the paper substantially at all. And he's probably right. I think ultimately, yeah. I mean, I see a migration back toward more credible sources, and anonymity has something to do with that. Paywalls have something to do with that, because, of course, if you've got a paywall and you're charging people access to your site after, I don't know, 8 free views or whatever, then they've got to give you a credit card for recurring monthly billing. That ends anonymity on the comments pages. Mm-hmm. And from several people I've talked to who've instituted paywalls, most notably over at the Columbia Daily Tribune, Andy Waters, their digital director across town, is delighted with what non-anonymity has done to the quality of the comments on his pages.
Right. And I wanted to also talk about the WikiLeaks case and how some of the lasting effects of that wholesale release of government secrets, and how the government reacted to it, and how that might impact the First Amendment freedoms.
Yeah, WikiLeaks is really interesting on so many levels, not the least of which is the criminalization of access to governmental secrets and the attempts by the United States to, at least from my perspective, to make Mr. Assange's life kind of a living nightmare until they ultimately could bring him here on charges. They seem sort of determined to do so, which I find incredibly disturbing. I am of the mindset that Mr. Assange, while ethically murky at times, is a whistleblower, that Bradley Manning is a whistleblower, that he is being persecuted legally for doing so, and that it is most troubling from a free speech perspective.
Yeah, the private who's being criminally prosecuted, he faces life in prison. That's a pretty strong message to
him. And is being kept in solitary confinement 24 hours a day.
What's your prediction on what's going to happen?
Ultimately, I think Manning is going to plead to some lesser charges. He's still going to do a long time in prison, I think. And Mr. Assange will fight extradition, probably ultimately successfully. The question is what happens to WikiLeaks in the future, because I think it's largely been rendered obsolete.
And why do you say that?
I just think Assange would be foolhardy to try anything. I mean, he may, but I just think he's probably pretty chilled by this.
Okay. I wanted to talk more, but I think we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Joining us today were Ken Paulson and Charles Davis. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio. It's been a fascinating conversation.
My pleasure, David. Anytime.
Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungkar is our executive producer. So join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
This episode of Global Journalist was originally recorded on November 15th, 2012.